Stanley Turrentine on tenor sax with a cute little number called Two Blue. Bob James, who did the arrangement for this tune, is on piano and electric organ. Eric Gale on guitar, Ron Carter on bass, and Idris Muhammad is on drums. This is from Turrentine's 1973 album, Don't Mess with Mr. T. He died after suffering a stroke on September the 12th in the year 2000. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find useful to you today. Certainly, it's been useful to me because we're going down. We keep updating and keep giving you reason to tune in for constant updates on the crime of the century, and that is the U.S. Clinton Foundation, U.S.-based. But as we'll talk about today, there are quite a few things brewing abroad as well. Credible sources have confirmed with Lead Stories that months-long FBI probes into the operations of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, we just called it the Clinton Foundation, will soon produce their first batch of federal indictments of key foundation personnel. The indictments, the sources said, are meant to send a signal to major targets of prosecution, most notably Bill and Hillary Clinton, that there'll be no wiggle room or very little wiggle room for negotiations on allegations of massive fraud. Charles Ortel, as you know, has been our guide for 2 years now on this story and is the leading expert on the Clinton Foundation, particularly from the point of view of charity fraud. He's a sworn enemy of charity fraud. And after retiring from Wall Street, he turned his talents to financial investigation and took on the Clinton Foundation as the first target. And he's been with this investigation since, bringing us up to date here on Lead Stories, bringing you inside information that nobody else has about the scope and impact of the Clinton Foundation. As you know, his investigations, we remind you, from a long time ago, led him to the conclusion that the Clinton Foundation is the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history. And it is alarming, Charles, that we don't get these kinds of updates in the major media. It's only here and on your brand new, spanking new YouTube program, Sunday with Charles. But first, good manners, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
It's an honor to be back on your show, Eutrice, or should I say Queen Eutrice?
Yeah, sure. How many people would believe that? You think about
many.
Three? Me, myself, and many. I? Okay, so what's going on here? We're hearing that some indictments will soon drop, and a large part of the reason is to send the message to the principals and other key players in the foundation that their time will soon also come.
Yeah, I think when Donald Trump and his team entered the various offices that they occupied starting afternoon on the 20th of January 2017, they could have only guessed the state of the Justice Department, the state of the IRS, the state of the FTC, the state of many regulatory branches, and the state of the State Department and its embassies around the world, because they were coming in flat-footed from the outside. and no amount of preparation could likely steal them to the reality they encountered of the epic level of fraud and corruption, I think, that was endemic, still may be endemic, inside our very own government. Now, the conclusion that I reached back in March of 2015 after several weeks' study was that the Clinton Foundation was such an obvious fraud that to allow it to flourish for so low these many years, in 2015, that was 18 years of flourishing, the oversight apparatus for the Clinton Foundation had to be crooked itself. And then when we saw the I realized the confirming evidence of Lois Lerner and her, the allegations about her and her people, that they were quite willing to weaponize the IRS against conservative groups. When I saw that, and I saw so many unanswered questions and so many stalled investigations, not simply the original one into the Clinton Foundation 2001-2005, but many other ones, I realized that what Donald Trump was campaigning for and what he won was a chance, or really a requirement, to upend the status quo in the Justice Department, in the IRS, and elsewhere, to bring it back into a balance where not only is no one above the law, but also the laws are fairly administered in relation to underlying facts. And I think what we saw, and will see as history unfolds here, what we will grow to understand is that it's likely that the Clinton team conned Team Obama initially, starting by June of 2008 when Hillary gave up her first quest to be the Democratic candidate. I think we will see, once we find these many missing emails, which I'm certain many governments have inside and outside this country, once we see those missing emails and once we uncover how many aliases were being used by the Clintons, by Team Obama and others, once we see all of these emails, whether written in English or other languages, we will grow to understand that the Clinton Foundation changed from being, a half-hearted attempt to build a complex out in Little Rock, starting in January of 2001 when Bill left the White House. It quickly became, a fake charity, fake arguments used around the world with crooked trustees and crooked accounting firms who didn't check anything. It became a traveling circus where you could go anywhere, meet with people who were inclined to support the Clinton team, and give them an excuse, instead of writing a check to the Clintons that's after-tax expensive money, they could write unlimited, and they were limited, actually, they could write unlimited checks to this false front foundation, and that money could be, create tax deductions for the donor. It could actually be create a tax deduction for the donor and even be round trip to the donor secretly via various means because there's no controls. And this thing, because it wasn't punished under George W. Bush's 8 years, which is a strange set of issues that needs investigation as well, because it wasn't punished, it flourished. And then once President Obama got into power, as has happened many times with the Clintons, he acceded to their request not to have an inspector general sit on top of the State Department. So we still don't know, and it's going to take us many years to figure out exactly how much money was stolen out of U.S. government coffers, principally, the massive State Department budget around the world. They give money for grants and projects all over the world, and, no one was checking that when Hillary was there. So we still don't know how much actually disappeared. There are rumors of $8, $10 billion or more. So this thing just got bigger and bigger, and it began to touch many, many people, establishment Republicans, Clintonista Democrats, Obama Democrats, private contractors. So many people are implicated here that I think we're going to quickly learn the comment about needing an insurance policy, whenever that came in 2016 between Strzok and his mistress Page, was spot on. The team who were involved in this longstanding criminal conspiracy to steal money from the American taxpayer and then to hide it and obstruct justice knew that if Donald Trump got elected, they couldn't control him. And so they've been on a campaign ever since. Donald Trump's given him the latitude to let this Mueller probe run and run and run. We've seen no evidence of Russian collusion so far. But what we can see clearly in the public records is the Clinton Foundation that, as we speak on this broadcast right now, is out raising money, even though its many public filings are all false and materially misleading. And so, you know, they're compounding their fraud. I have been hearing for months now that the people who used to be Eric Braverman and others who either were or still are at the Clinton Foundation may well have been talking to the FBI and to other authorities. And, you know, I think by January 4th, when there was public confirmation that the FBI indeed had been investigating it, we learned that when we learned that the IRS had been investigating this thing since July of 2016, it would take a fourth grader who had an affinity for math and accounting to see that this was a fraud in about 2 seconds. So why has it taken the Dallas office of the IRS, lo, these many months, to do something about it? So I think what we're on now, and I don't know for certain, I'm just surmising, is that inside this country, finally, Donald Trump has people appointed as U.S. attorneys in the FBI and elsewhere in the Justice Department who are pursuing this investigation, comparing what they find to the law. They've decided that it is a case worth going after as a guest. And we have the spectacle of Corinne Brown reporting for jail, federal prison, a former congressman, a 71-year-old African-American formerly representing Jacksonville, Democrat. Comey goes after her. The Justice Department goes after her over an $800,000 fraud in which she plays a partial role. And she's now going to go to prison January 29th, 2018, for 5 long years at age 71. So why, please tell me, why Hillary Clinton gets to run for president and now gets to, you know, swan between her two mansions, one in Chappaqua filled with Chardonnay and one in D.C. filled with who knows what. Why does she go free? Why does she get treated as if she's the Queen of England in these, you know, in the conversation that she deigned to have with her co-conspirators back in July 2nd, I think, 2016? Why does she get that kind of treatment as Corinne Brown is railroaded through the courts and then slammed into prison for 5 years? So the rumors that you mentioned make a lot of sense to me. I mean, Donald Trump is determined, and his people and his voters, and frankly, voters who didn't necessarily like Trump but liked a lot of what Bernie had to say about cleaning up the swamp, across this country, people are sick and tired of elected leaders, be they Republican or Democrats, you know, living the life of millionaires, never having actually accumulated any wealth in the private sector with their security guards and their fancy trips and their fancy meetings and all their staffs and all that and their benefits that few Americans actually get. I think Americans are sick of that, and we want to see, I know I want to see, the swamp drained, and I want to see people. If it's Peter Strzok, if it's James Comey, if it's even Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein and people inside the Justice Department have been abusing the law and doing so, perhaps like Lois Lerner, to enrich themselves, we want to see the full truth of that. Those crimes are every bit as bad as the hustlers who are out there dealing drugs on street corners or pimping women. And, you know, it's high time that the seamy underbelly of this globalist corruption gets exposed into full view, and people have been running roughshod over we the people, this country, and our long distinguished history. Those people need to be exposed fully. They need to be punished severely, including financial restitution and jail time. They need to be made an example of. And I think that will do many good things for all of us.
Well, the noose is tightening, supposedly, around the Clintons and the foundation itself, but not only within the borders of the United States. We have indications that overseas as well, there has been a ramping up of investigations into the Clinton Foundation. Now, why did it take so long overseas, considering that the Clintons and the foundation, the eponymous foundation, kind of specialized in exporting their criminality by going into countries where there isn't much of an apparatus, an investigative apparatus, nor perhaps a zeal by the ruling authorities to take a look at the Clintons because of political considerations and so forth. But it's kind of upsetting to me that they were very careful to select countries, black countries, Indian countries, where Indian states, I should say, where they had apparently a very generous indulgence by the authorities to do whatever it is they wanted to do. And so they proceeded to do it. What do you know of these investigations overseas?
Well, so when I started on this project, I realized back in 2015 that I had to contemplate the possibility that Hillary Clinton might win. And had Hillary won, we wouldn't probably be having this long conversation right now. But she didn't win. And so what I figured out is that I saw a lot of foreign governments contributing to this Clinton Foundation. I saw that fact being hidden in the IRS tax forms, which have still not been corrected for 1998 to 2007. Those forms still list no government contributions of any kind, though there were massive contributions by governments in that time frame. So when I saw that, and I saw an opportunity through friends located in these countries to reach out to those friends, all of whom are seasoned investigators, and say, listen, I see a real problem here. I'm an American. I can't do anything about it in Australia or Sweden or France or the UK, but you can. And here's what I see. Why don't you take what I see, think about it, think for yourself, and why don't you reach in to your various governments and tell them, you know, there's a serious problem here. You've been contributing hundreds of millions of dollars. In the case of France, $650 million went to UNITAID, of which a majority, slightly less than a majority, went to the Clinton Foundation in a short period of time. Why would you not care what happened about $650 million? It's a lot of money to kind of just disappear. Particularly in France, when you got to take care of all these, you know, the disruption created by this flood of refugees and an economy that's not going anywhere. You know, why don't you care about all this money? I mean, this is taxpayer money. So those sorts of entreaties went out to multiple, you know, through friends of mine, to multiple governments. And almost uniformly, the response came back and said, you know, look, Hillary Clinton's going to be your next president, and we really don't want to be on the wrong side of Hillary Clinton as president of the United States of America, because we saw what happened when Bill was president, and we know what happened when he was governor, and we can only imagine what the Clintons will do if she's president, with, you know, having made all sorts of money personally and having had decades now to insert friends into regulatory bodies around the world, into governments around the world. Basically, you know, these donor governments just didn't want to take on Hillary Clinton as potentially, you know, the leader of the free world from the outside of the United States of America. And then Trump happened. And, one of the stages of grief, the anger, denial, acceptance, whatever, I mean, one needed to go through those various stages of grief. And, you know, many of the nations that were important donors to the Clinton Foundation are nations that are reflexively left-leaning. I mean, America is not, when you look through the various polls, sure, here in Manhattan and California and maybe places in Florida and Chicago, whatever, it's left-leaning. But when you look at the mass of the American voter, it's a center-right country. But not so across Europe, not so in Canada, not so in Australia or Norway, Scandinavia. So in many of these donor nations, many of them were small, are small, their economies are small, and the leaders saw an opportunity by cozying up to the Clintons, by embracing the globalism that the Clintons and George Soros and even the Bush family love. These leaders of former countries saw an opportunity to emulate the Clintons, to create their own foundations, to insert their people into the UN, indeed to become high positions of high authority. They're Clinton associates. Some one is currently the head of the World Bank. Another, was at one time ahead of WHO. They have them scattered throughout all these globalist organizations. And so they saw an opportunity in Clinton, in the Clinton model, just follow up the Clinton model to enrich themselves, picking the pockets of these globalist multilateral agencies for either projects that they themselves pursue or projects that their political donors want to pursue around the world. So it was a very unregulated globalism is fantastic, particularly if you can use it, I'm saying that sarcastically, to corner the world market for uranium, let's say, or other world markets, or to get valuable monopolies on wireless, or near monopolies on wireless services, or valuable mining concessions, or oil and gas and energy concessions around the world. You get to fly around the world at somebody else's expense in a fancy plane, stay in the presidential suite, go in limousines, eat fine food, drink to your heart's content, taste women or whatever you want to chase around, in the confines of this, your entourage. And all the while, you get to tell the public that you're doing good. You're doing God's work. You're doing charitable work. I mean, it's really disgusting, frankly. And a lot of these people, I call them the 13 BlackBerry crowd. The Rajat Guptas and the Hillary Clintons. They have multiple BlackBerries. They're always doing too much at once. They can't get anything really done because they're just doing too much. That crowd, saw the Clintons go from dead broke in 2000 to being worth, what, $200, $300, who knows how many million dollars as philanthropists. They saw that and they said, we can do this. And so they didn't want to fight it. And they, bought into the theory that maybe with Soros money, Trump would be not able to actually make it to inauguration. Then he did that. Then maybe the Mueller probe was going to, dispatch Trump. Well, that didn't happen. Now he's almost a year in. And I think what's happened is that around the world, people have realized that the pendulum has switched. And it's a lot more sensible at this point to cooperate and expose this fraud and make sure you're not part of it. Then it makes a lot more sense to do that than to, at this stage, resist. Which is why in recent days I have been, relentlessly not going after Chelsea, but in sort of what I consider to be a fair-minded, good-hearted approach, trying to coach somebody who's younger than I am. When you reach the conclusion that your parents are not, great people, that the critics of the parents have actually been right, that they're just endemic fraudsters who've gotten away with fraud their entire adult lives. When you reach that conclusion, you have to face a simple choice. Do you want to join the fraternity and sorority of fraudsters? You want to be that person? Or do you want to look your parent? You want to grow up? You're way older than 21. You want to grow up, lift yourself up, look your father in the eye, look your mother in the eye and say, listen, I ain't doing this. I am not doing this. Okay, it is reprehensible to steal money from desperately poor people around the world to lead the champagne and caviar lifestyle we've been leading in my $20 million or $10 million Soho loft or wherever it is, and our mansions in Chappaqua and our mansions in D.C., if that was gleaned by ripping off, as you say, Utrecht, brown people in Papua New Guinea and Haiti and Africa and India, ripping off the aid flows that was sent to them, using this construction to create, multi-billion dollar profits for our donors, if that's what we've been doing all along, I want no part of it. And you either, mom and dad, stand up and admit your sins, or I'm going to help the prosecution. That simple. That's where she is right now. She cannot, write cute little tweets anymore and attack Donald Trump superficially. That lady has to grow up and define herself. And she will define herself in coming days either as, a dupe of her parents, not that smart, and a criminal, or somebody who really should be admired. Standing up and resisting her own parents. That's where she is right now. And to the extent she wants to stand up and resist her own parents, I will applaud that. Difficult. Not easy to put your parents in jail. But that's where they belong, both of them. And if instead Chelsea makes the decision to support her parents, no mercy. I have no sympathy.
Well, it's not just about supporting the parents. It's about supporting the bennies that she herself had enjoyed over time. I want to just go back a little bit and put some context here. When we are talking about the Clinton Foundation and the assertion that it's the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history, we're really talking about how the Clintons and others, but we are focusing on the Clintons right now, the business model that they kind of, maybe they didn't invent it, but they certainly invented the scope that that business model could be made to perform in order to bring them individually, bring them handsome returns. The idea here, which is why you're in this game of tracking the fraud, because it is associated with philanthropy, supposedly. But we discussed early on in the game that this has nothing to do with philanthropy. The Clinton Foundation was organized and, if you will, licensed to do one thing, and that was to build a building to house the presidential papers of one William Jefferson Clinton in Arkansas. That was all. That was it. There was no other permission granted, no other license given to do anything else. But soon we found that the Clinton Foundation was doing all kinds of things all over the world, establishing all kinds of affiliates and different organizations operating under the Clinton Global Initiative banner, including, you know, a program to rid the world of AIDS and HIV, programs involving farmers all over the world. So it ceased really early after its formation. It ceased to be specific in terms of its mission, and apparently was allowed to just stretch as wide as they wanted to because there was money in attracting the interest of well-placed people. And this was the model. The model was to represent, or more accurately, misrepresent what this foundation was doing. And it was no longer about putting Bill Clinton's presidential papers in the building. It was about something else. Could you talk about that and the business model itself encouraging this level of fraud?
Sure. Let me back up a little bit, because you know what you said is interesting and it needs to be clarified a little bit. So the Presidential Libraries Act of 1955 made clear that the purpose, and it was amended in 86, but it made clear that the purpose of these presidential libraries was not to house Bill Clinton's papers, but to house our papers, federal records, what are called presidential records, the federal records that were created during Bill Clinton's two terms as president, are the property of the United States of America. And now as we watch what's going on with the Barack Obama Library, where no one seems to know where the presidential records of the Obama presidency are at the moment, comes the question of, you know, what is really the purpose of these presidential libraries? The papers that are created during a president's term are the property of we, the people. We paid for them. We get to study them. And ordinarily, if a presidential library is not created, they would sit in the National Archives, and anybody who wanted to research them could see all unclassified papers created during a president's term. That's the way it works. So what began was an idea to save the United States of America money, that private supporters of a given president might be allowed to help the government out by paying for these facilities, because, you know, people began to realize we might have many, many presidents, and suddenly there would be the need for many, many libraries, and, you know, why should the United States be in the library building business? So a compromise of sorts was made that the presidential libraries could come into fruition, the U.S. would be better off because private parties would fund the capital costs and also provide an endowment to help, fund the ongoing expenses of a foundation. So that was the original idea. And and over time, the first bump in the road came in the Nixon time frame, when there was a debate about what exactly whose property were the various musings of Richard M. Nixon, where were these papers and who had them and whatever. So the Presidential Records Act of 1978 was enacted, and that defines in very explicit terms what are presidential records and what are not presidential records. So the first mistake, I would argue, in the Clinton Foundation is it actually dates October 23rd, 1997, when it was organized, in that the application of the IRS suggested that, inaccurately, frankly, that the foundation that was going to be created would more or less, it was imprecise as to what records and what items would be stored in the building itself. So I think, you know, if I had been involved back then and knew now what I know, or knew then what I know now, I would have, if I had anything to do with it, I would say, listen, you really need to tighten this definition up a lot, because the records created over 8 years of Bill Clinton being president are a massive amount of information, and they will pale in comparison to whatever records Bill has squirreled away in the White House, because back then Bill and Hillary didn't have a house until 1999, I believe, when they got Chappaqua. So there's no way the records that Bill and Hillary had personally would be even 1% of the records that are stored, in theory, in Little Rock. So I would have tightened that up. Now, the other thing that's very important to understand is that, you know, the federal government cannot be in the business of just creating, you know, business opportunities with individuals or whatever. So there were strict rules as to what form these presidential foundations needed to be in. And there's two types. There's a private foundation, which would be the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, effectively controlled by the donors. That is not what a presidential foundation is supposed to be. A presidential foundation must be a public charity. And by that, I mean, can't be dominated by the Clinton family or any family. It's got to be wholly representative of the public at large. After all, why would you say that it's okay to give all of the records created during Bill Clinton's presidency or any presidency to a foundation controlled by the president? You know, if he were a crook, God forbid, and wanted to hide, you know, evidence of crimes, what better way to do that than to ensure that all the papers created during his presidency would go to a foundation that he would control, and therefore deny access to any investigators who may want to figure out whether he actually contributed crimes that are actionable. So, you know, on the face of it, the thing began in error, I would argue, on October 23, 1997, just when Bill started to come, and Hillary, under massive pressure, the Paula Jones lawsuit was allowed to proceed. Discovery was allowed to proceed. And, you know, actually, I think it's 20 years ago to this day is when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And by year-end 1997, the first presidential expense trust had blown up. They couldn't use it anymore because there were foreign people involved with it. So they had to create a new one. And, you know, it was a horrible moment in Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's period. They were dead broke. They faced gigantic legal bills. The scandal with Lewinsky threatened to, you know, maybe even cause Bill to be kicked out as president. So it was a horrible period of time. And in that horrible period of time, what they were supposed to have been doing was to register this presidential foundation after it got federal tax exemption on the, I think, 29th January 1998. They needed to then, with that in hand, get state tax exemption. And there is evidence that they began doing that in certain states, the problem being that Bill was in the process of being impeached for lying under oath and obstructing justice. And when you set up a charity and you have people involved with that charity, even if they're not necessarily named as executives, as directors or directors, but if they have an ability to substantially influence the affairs of a foundation, then those people's defects in their record need to be disclosed. And it certainly is a defect to have surrendered your law license for lying under oath and obstructing justice early in 2001, something that has not been disclosed in any of the state filings. So this thing, you know, I joke, and it's a sad joke, that if you want to figure out how to run a foundation, U.S. tax-exempt foundation, that is going to operate internationally, the way you figure out how to do it correctly is by doing the opposite of what the Clinton Foundation has done since birth. So that, just anything they've done, you can assume it's wrong. And then you need to go back and look at the rules. So what happened, Utrice, is they used this foundation, I would argue, in the period while Bill was still president, as a means to solicit money to pay their legal expenses as a guest and also to fund Hillary's Senate campaign. And since he was president, since, you know, he sat over top justice in the IRS, since it was assumed that a Democrat would succeed him, they were sloppy. And the record, the public record that exists, you know, now the FBI is looking at it. The first thing they should do is find the 1997 tax return, which I submit doesn't exist. Then they need to find all these state registrations, which the FBI certainly can get. And, you know, it won't take them long to see that by the time Bill left in 2001 in disgrace, frankly, the foundation was, I would argue, legally moribund. I mean, it was the only way you could continue to operate the foundation would be to lie, which is what they did. And they continue to operate. It is so strange that Mueller's FBI, beginning the 4th of September 2001, Comey's U.S. attorney for the Southern District, couldn't catch this fraud as it started to escalate outside our borders. Bill began making statements once he, you know, figured out he wasn't president anymore, that he wanted to do all these international big causes. They created a foundation with a similar sounding name, the Clinton Family Foundation up in Chappaqua in 2001, that was supposed to be a grant-making thing. And then, you know, as a guest, if you've been the president of the United States for 8 years and you're a young person, he was relatively young when he left, you know, you're not going to listen to anybody, right? You're the top dog. You know, I mean, you were president of the United States, you know, now you're in retirement, the world, you got friends around the world. You don't want to listen to the naysayers who say, hey, President, you can't do what you're doing here. Eventually you're going to get, shut up. I'm the President of the United States. You know, who are you? You're just some advisor. You're some pesky little lawyer. You know, as a guest, that's what was going on. And when they weren't caught, you know, he proceeded to put his name on as many things. He put his name on honorary chairman of the International AIDS Trust, a fraud. Honorary chairman of the American India Foundation, a fraud. And he wasn't caught. So he just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, the game became that they had to get, you know, as the thing got bigger and bigger and the fraud got bigger and bigger, they had to make sure that Hillary ultimately would be president. And then they could have attempted to vacuum all these records and sweep them away and, you know, argue you're past the statute of limitations, all that stuff, but that didn't happen. And so this HIV/AIDS fighting stuff, you know, it's interesting. I'm very squeamish, so I have a hard time understanding medical issues, but I think I understand that, you know, there's a big difference between saying you have HIV, you're going to cure HIV or retard HIV, and curing AIDS. Big difference. And so people will go run around the world and say, well, I'm going to cure AIDS. Well, okay, if you can do that, you're certainly going to get a Nobel Prize. You might become a billionaire. That's hard. Retarding the spread of HIV is something that was known how to do long before the Clintons got involved with it. And, you know, if you're going to go around the world saying that you're distributing drugs, there are on-point legal cases that say that the distribution of drugs is not necessarily a charitable activity. That when you change your purposes from being a library in Little Rock to an international organization promoting or efforts to stop the spread spread of HIV into AIDS. If you do that, you have to make sure that your purposes and your articles of incorporation have in fact been amended. You've got to consult with the IRS. If you consult with the IRS, there's got to be a record that you did that. And your articles of incorporation need to show that you changed your purpose from being a domestic presidential library in Little Rock, being a global enterprise run from Boston, Massachusetts, that you're, you know, going to use in some way to attack the HIV/AIDS problem. And you've got to be very specific and detailed about it. So those papers are coming to light, the papers that were used to create this fiction that this presidential foundation was allowed to do these various purposes. And unfortunately, a lot of times people are like this, you know, the grand thinkers are often hopeless when it comes to details. And the grand thinker, Ira Magaziner, has his signature on a lot of incriminating documents, as does Bruce Lindsay, as does Ed Wood, as do many people who have got to be looking at this Titanic and saying, you know, I've got years left to live on the planet. I don't want to spend them in jail. You know, I'm not. I see how the Clintons treat, you know, people to stay out of jail. So, you know, I don't see them being any friend of mine. I see the Clintons facing a gigantic legal bill and financial penalties and maybe jail time. So when you look at this public record, it's disgusting. And, you know, especially in Massachusetts.
But you're seeing also a deliberate effort to deceive and to disguise what their real intention was, which was to zero in on projects that they could sell to a gullible class of donors or people who probably also knew, even as they made these multi-million dollar donations to them, that this wasn't about whatever it is they claimed it was going to be, about taking on the HIV/AIDS crisis all over the world. They knew that. They also knew that the drugs that they were using were adulterated drugs, and their partner in this was a person who admitted, as a matter of fact, that the drugs were watered down and were no good. They were outdated, and he paid a $500,000 fine. $500 million fine. So all around, all these aspects of it would suggest that the intention was to deliberately engage in criminal acts and then deceiving. They didn't file the appropriate reports. They didn't seek to get the authority and permission of the IRS to have them change their scope from a presidential library project to all these various projects all over the place that would be sold to governments and to very wealthy individuals as the Clintons doing good works, as they called it, all over the world. There had been no reporting, no documented reporting of where the money systematically went. So it's not just hundreds of millions of dollars that are unaccounted for. This business model allowed them probably to enrich themselves to the tune of billions of dollars. And still we don't know. Yeah. We know, for example, the Haiti question, which we've talked about quite a bit on the program, $10 billion from that alone. From Papua New Guinea, $100 million. Nobody knows where the money is going.
Right.
So at some point, I think they ought to dispense with this idea of a forensic accounting and just go straight for the jugular. These things all are saying the same thing. A lot of money was raised. Even Chelsea Clinton, when she was in Haiti, was so distressed about what she saw and raised questions with her parents about, well, where's the money going? You build six houses and they're not substantial. And you right. had a budget of $10 billion and nobody knows where the money went. I mean, this is serious Bonnie and Clyde kind of philanthropy here.
Bonnie and Clyde Capone. yeah, it's really something else. I mean, I think, you know, now that progress has been made on in certain areas, and now Donald Trump approaches his second year, the start of his second year, you know, what I see as a way forward here, because the facts are on the side of the prosecutors. There's a very simple set of pressure points that needs to be applied here. One needs to take the largest donors to the Clinton Foundation, the private foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Robert W. Johnson Foundation, and others like it that have a lot to lose here because they have made what are called illegal tax expenditures. They have made contributions to Clinton supposed projects that are in fact not charitable. And the Clinton Foundation ceased being a public charity, in my mind, on November 2nd, 2013, when they illegally gave control of the entire operation to Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea. That is something you're not allowed to do. And they did that. It's a matter of record. So you pay a call to Bill Gates, or you have Gates come to you, and you say, listen, dude, you're rich. You have a lot of your wealth in this foundation. And, you know, you could fight us because you got resources, but you're not going to win. Or you can, you know, you can make, you can find a new kind of religion and you could direct with your resources a real independent review of all of your grants, including starting with those to the Clinton Foundation, to tell us all of the grants that you have made since the inception of your foundation to entities that you thought were charities that are not charities, because we know that all the grants you made to the Clinton Foundation were not to public charity. So there have got to be other ones. And you can make that full and fair disclosure. You can cooperate with us, and we promise we will be lenient, but you're going to pay serious penalties. Or you can fight us. If you fight us, we will destroy you. All of your money is going to go to pay down the debt. All of your money, all of your assets around the world.
Which leads me to this question. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't an independent authority come forward and demanded that an investigation follow a particular line, just as you were just discussing, in the interest of the, for lack of a better term, in the interest of the industry, the philanthropic industry, the philanthropic world? Has no one stepped forward in the interest of keeping the reputation of the philanthropic world kind of clean and registered with authorities that they are troubled by certain developments and they are encouraging a thorough and immediate investigation?
Well, a brave academic in England, Lindsay McGooey, I think. I forget if it's N-C-G-O-E-Y, I think is the name. I think she wrote something like, no such thing as a free gift. And it's all about the Gates Foundation and the bad impact that the Gates Foundation has had on the charitable world. It is so big, it gives to so many charities that you're loath to criticize the Gates Foundation if you're in the charitable sector. They also give to all the major universities, which would be the second piece of the puzzle here, that these large endowed private universities. The more I think about it, the madder I get about it. Because you know, back in the day, when I enrolled at Yale in 1974, I think things were more in balance then. And the scholars at the universities went to universities to study, to advance the frontiers of human knowledge and understanding. That's why they were scholars. They weren't there trying to make a quick buck as a venture capitalist or in a hedge fund or on some international project that sounded fun. And they certainly didn't go to universities to become multimillionaires. You know, you weren't paid all that. Well, you were paid, you had free housing, stuff like that, or discounted housing, but you didn't sign up to be a scholar because you expected to be a multimillionaire. And in the intervening now 44 years, what has emerged with globalism is a system where, you know, people around the world love the idea of sending, you know, eldest son or eldest daughter or, you know, the kids to a brand name university so they could wear Harvard insignia hats and Yale hats and Columbia hats and stuff like that. And there are only so many spaces. The number of spaces at these universities hasn't really increased all that much. And so the supply and demand for brand name university places is tipped in favor of these universities, who find themselves now, you know, being able to take down gigantic amounts of money and contributions. They don't need to listen to any single donor because their endowments are so big. They have tenure. And, you know, you look at I like to look at sort of, I don't know, just surface level clues at first. I mean, look at the cost of sending a child, a youngster, to Yale today. I believe it's approaching $75,000 per year. You can't get a $75,000 per year job that easily. You certainly can't get a $300,000 job. In reality, you need to get a $600,000 one-year payment to pay off $300,000 of school costs. So why are the costs of these universities exploded? Why are they serving so many international people and not helping Americans? Why are scholars, you know, concentrating on making money instead of curing cancer or, you know, solving tractable math or science problems or doing a, you know, detailed review of what really happened prior to 1492 in America? Be interesting, or prior to 1066 in England, so topics like that, really getting into history and, you know, the various disciplines. Why isn't that happening? And why have all these august universities supported the Clinton Foundation frauds, putting their stamp of approval on it in 2003 when the HIV/AIDS operation of the Clinton Foundation certainly was boldly illegal? Why was this this AIDS treatment consortium, how did that come together involving Harvard, Columbia, and other universities? Did nobody at those universities understand charity law? And if so, you know, what the hell were they doing in these universities? All these universities are charities. So there's a lot of explaining to do, and one could make a lot of progress here using the Clinton Foundation as a textbook example, as I think your sources indicate that they might be doing, and then having tough discussions. Start with the biggest donor, you know, one of the big ones, the Gates Foundation. And then go down the list, and then turn your attention to the foreign governments and say, okay, France, you know, why did you do this? Yes, we're partially responsible in America. You know, I wasn't president back then, Trump could say. I'm not part of the, you know, Republican and Democratic establishment. You know, why did you do this for so many years? And how about you, Theresa May in England? Why were you doing this? How about you over in Norway? How come you're still doing this? What about you, Justin Trudeau? Why did you just announce you're going to put another $20 million into this fraud? How about you over in Australia? We had a tough conversation at the beginning of last year. You know, what the hell have you been doing?
Very, very important questions. Well, Charles, we leave it here for today. I just want to have you talk a little bit about your own program, since sure. You're now a mega media mogul. you've had so much information that you actually ended up starting a YouTube channel, and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, thank you, Teresa, and thanks for letting me come on these many hours. This is a subject which really defies soundbite journalism. I mean, there's so many nuggets, there's so many chapters, there are actually so many volumes explaining this fraud that as I interact a lot on TV and the radio with people, and I know now a bunch of these producers, I came to realize that the traditional approach of trying to spread the word was not going to work on cable or network television or even on radio, and that the better way to do it was the way I used to do business in board presentations that frequently might last. Some board presentations I've been in lasted, you know, many days. Obviously, people went home to sleep. So we decided I met this great person, Jason Goodman, who's a Hollywood producer, filmmaker, and a lot of experience. And we tested a few things, and then we lit on this idea of just doing a weekly show. Sometimes we do an extra edition, but it's always Sunday. And we typically try to do it 3 o'clock Eastern. And the typical show lasts for 2 hours, 2.5, maybe 3 hours. And we take a portion of this scandal and we go and do a deep dive in a YouTube format, a video format. Sometimes we have guests, expert guests, and we provide slides, actually, you know, printed slides with links to source materials so that prosecutors and investigators can save time understanding this. And we have a playlist that's up on the site, so you can go and you can start at the beginning on August 27th, I think it was, or thereabouts, 2017. There are more than 20 shows so far, and I'm very thank you to the viewers of Crowdsource the Truth. Typical show will get at least 20,000 viewers, which is a lot for you know, something as long as 2 hours. I think so the global market...
It's on Sundays at 3. It's called Sundays with Charles. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Ring of Fire Radio. And Charles, once more, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.